You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Good morning. Fantastic to see you. And I'm really enjoying that this is coming straight after worship. The kingdom of God is near. Let's keep that very much to the forefront. We are a people of hope. We are an Easter people. I just want to say that right at the beginning, because this is a subject that can sometimes get people a little bit anxious. So let's just keep that really clear, front and center throughout this conversation. This is not the first time that Christian nationalism has been discussed at this Greenbelt. There was a panel at almost exactly the same time yesterday, looking at how do we think about Christian nationalism, and our title was, what do we do about it? Well, those two kind of bleed into each other quite a lot, and I think a lot of yesterday focused on what we can do about it. One of the things I think we're going to do a little bit more on today is a bit more on what is it and why is it now, as it were. So a bit more of the what and the why. So a bit more around the analysis, perhaps, than might be flagged in what's in your programs. So we're going to do a little bit more about that. Can I just quickly check? I'm slightly blinded by the light here, so I'm going to put my hand up there because I'm going to need to see this. Can I just check how many people were at yesterday's session on this? Whoa, quite a lot of you have come back. Okay, different panel, different input, so we'll kind of see how that goes. Thank you, that's very helpful. And then a second thing is, at the panel yesterday, the panelists were asked kind of how long have they had Christian nationalism on their radar? When did they first hear about it? That sort of question. So can I just check with people here? Could you stick your hand in the air if you hadn't heard or thought about Christian nationalism until this weekend? Okay, one or two. How many people for whom this is the last 6 months? Okay, last year? Okay, last year. Last 3 years? And maybe the last 5 years. Okay, that's quite interesting. So kind of looks like last 3 years is the kind of modal position. That's really helpful. Gives me a good sense. Thank you very much for that. Okay. So it seems to me we're looking at a complex and fast-moving situation. We've all been very aware of the last few years about the rise of far-right politics. We've seen the symbols, the mythology, the identity, the flags. We've also seen the reshaping of our politics, not just in the UK, but across Europe and globally. We've also seen a shift in what we've come, what many of us are now using as expression, the Overton window, where things have the expectations of what is normal has shifted. I remember back in 2019, I think it was, Boris Johnson was Foreign Secretary. And when he became Foreign Secretary, I remember being shocked and scandalized that somebody with clearly racist views had come into that role. And I can feel that sense of shock from then. And that feels like, whoa, that was a long time ago. A lot has happened since then. So we've got that sense of things shifting. There's a global picture to this. We've seen the rise, not just of Christian associations with politics, but if you go across to India, we have Modi and the rise of right-wing Hinduism, and we see this in, so there's a broader pattern that we've come used to seeing. And then, of course, in the last few years, we've had the madness and the extraordinary acceleration of some of these developments with Trump in the US. So things are changing, things are shifting quite fast. What is religious capture at one side? What is it where politicians and political bodies have tried to capture religion? And in what time, you know, on the other side of that, what about the way that religion and Christian communities and identities are seeking to be politicized? So those are kind of two sides or two ways of looking at what we're going to be exploring. And then alongside that, I think we need to have a bit of a think about liberal democracy. Because liberal democracy is, and liberalism more broadly, is clearly in a lot of difficulty. So I think that may be another part of the things that we pick up on. We've also seen an increased coordination between right-wing intellectuals in the US and both Catholic and Protestant articulations. J.D. Vance is probably the most obvious person involved there. And let me just add one more angle. So I'm really mounting it up for the panelists here. Let me just throw in one more angle as well, and that is the fetishization of masculinity. A lot of this right-wing politics and Christian nationalism is bound in with ideas about a kind of hegemonic masculinity, a certain way that you have to be a male person and a male Christian, brackets, white person. So that's just another angle that we might want to consider. So how's this going to work? I'm going to turn in a moment to our panelists. Each are going to talk for about 5 minutes or so. I may just throw a few additional questions. There may be a bit of chat between us. We may interrupt each other, that sort of thing. And then towards the end, we'll have 20 minutes of Q&A from the room. So let me start by welcoming and just saying how delighted and excited I am to have today's panelists. Let me start with Chinny McDonald, who's extremely well known to you and to everybody here as the vice chair of Greenbelt, a veteran of many panelists and of many stages here, the author of Unmaking Mary, Shattering the Myth of Perfect Motherhood, which I'm sure you all have all bought. Have you all bought?
Yeah.
Great. And God is Not a White Man. Very much somebody in the public space, the public square, as the director of Theos. So someone who's very much in that public space and monitoring that. A particular thanks to you because you're standing in for Anthony Reddy, who unfortunately has not been able to join us this weekend. At the far end, we have Luke Bretherton, Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology of Christ Church, Oxford, who's also spent a lot of time at Duke University in the US, and I think that'll be a really helpful bit of input in terms of that perspective. Theology and politics is very much his focus, but he's very interested in grassroots democratic processes and has a podcast called Listen, Organize, and Act. And next to me, we have Harriet, the principal of Ripon College, Cudston, who's done a lot of work around leadership, particularly what compassionate leadership looks like. Her day job is about training clergy. And then just to go back a little bit, back in 1998, she published a really important book on fundamentalism and evangelicalism. And I think it might be interesting just to reflect on the shift from 98 onwards. She also has extensive experience of chaplaincy and of living and working in Scotland, where nationalism has a slightly different feel about it. So we might be useful to hear a bit about that. So I'm going to start by asking Luke to pick up the microphone. Luke recently talked to the House of Bishops of the Church of England and said, don't use the phrase Christian nationalism. So, Luke, tell us a little bit about Christian nationalism.
Thank you, Duncan. Really, first of all, just want to say what a delight and honour it is to be with you all. I'm going to offer kind of three broadly interlinked reflections. They're not meant to be definitive words. They're kind of invitations for you to kind of think further about this and hopefully open up different kind of horizons on which to consider what's going on around us and ask ourselves what's going on here. So the first one is around this term Christian nationalism, and you'll have to excuse me, I'm going to be a terrible kind of pedantic academic for a moment, which is my kind of day job. And my kind of concern about the term is I'd been living in America for the past 13 years and saw this term emerge. It first emerges in kind of academic literature, sociological literature, around 2010. And it's sociologists, a lot of very good people, trying to think about the intensification of the connection between particularly white evangelicals, mainly from a kind of suburban context, and their connection with certain strands of right-wing politics which are emerging in the wake of 9/11, and kind of concerns there expressed there around anti-Islam, what then emerges in the kind of later noughties as a kind of anti-woke sensibility, and we see within that the rise of Trump and others. And the sociologists are trying to think about that term. It's a very how they define it, how they understand it, is a very American context around very strong commitments to church-state separation, how they understand the role of the church in public life. I don't think those concerns are that helpful in a British context. But they are trying to kind of get at something. Now, part of what they're trying to get at is actually quite a long history in the States, and I think, and Harriet can speak to this, kind of long histories in this country as well. So you think back, some of you, like me, are old enough to remember kind of Christians you were in church with who were very pro-Thatcher and couldn't understand why everyone was so upset about apartheid. What was wrong with that? And we can think back to various iterations of this kind of orientation. And what we're seeing is that, I think that kind of current has always been present in the churches, and it's being picked up and developed. Now, I think the kind of first invitation is to think about, when you're talking about Christian nationalism, ask yourself, who are you actually talking about? What are there actual specific people in specific places do you think that term names? And then what do you think you're naming by using that term? Now, I think there are very real things going on. I think there is a kind of shift. Again, what we're seeing is a resurgence. We can go back to the 1920s and 30s. There's something called Action Française, which was a kind of early pre-runner of fascism, that strapline was defending family, faith, and flag. And hundreds of thousands of Catholics in France joined it, so much so the Pope had to issue an edict saying priests would be defrocked and you couldn't take Eucharist if you joined Action Française. And this is a kind of reaction against a move to kind of build up a liberal democratic kind of state. It was a reaction against communism. And I think, again, I've just pointed to a historical analog. I think we're seeing similar political theology, similar views coming back. And very explicitly, we have figures in America like Adrian Vermeule, people like Curtis Yarvin, who's a big figure that J.D. Vance and Peter Thiel like. They are explicitly referencing folk who were involved in this movement. They're picking up on someone called Carl Schmitt, who was a Nazi jurist. They're picking up on people like Peter Morat, who was a kind of key figurehead in the Action Française. And they're kind of reinscribing this view. And they're doing it because one of the real things we're seeing around us is a return of a kind of authoritarian politics that's anti-democratic, anti-liberal. By that I mean they're just anti the rule of law, anti the limited state. They're anti the welfare state. They're anti a pluralistic, culturally diverse society. They want a more monocultural. And frankly, it's the return. We see a return of a kind of social Darwinian, biologically racist current. And again, it's very explicit in these kinds of figures, Curtin Yarvin being a good example. Now, the question is, why is that why are Christians, to take those two sides of the kind of equation that Duncan was outlining, why are Christians kind of joining this kind of authoritarian politics? Well, I think we are in a particular cultural moment, which is different from the 20s and 30s. There were particular historical and political and economic dynamics there, and there are particular ones we're addressing. And one way to think about this is my kind of second point, is we're in a moment when we are suffering a kind of what I would call a crisis of agency. Most of us and most folk, whether they're struggling to make ends meet, whether they are subject to forces, do you get the interview, the mortgage, the surgery, some AI force decides that you don't really understand, you're subject to economic forces, whether it's wars in the Middle East suddenly affecting petrol prices. We're all subject to these huge social, economic, political forces we have no control over, and find our lives and ourselves determined by decisions taken elsewhere about us, without us. And so there is this deep crisis of agency. People feel powerless across the political spectrum. At the same time, we live in a culture, which is what the Korean-American philosopher Byung Chul Han calls an achievement society. We no longer live in the kind of what we might call a disciplinary society where we're endlessly told by the institutions and authority figures, you should obey us. No. We're told, you should live your best life now. We strive for our lives. We kind of live by our Apple Watches. We're endlessly told how to optimize our diets. We are endlessly kind of trying to kind of live our best lives now. And so in the midst of this, there is a contradiction. We are constantly surrounded by media influences and messages in the newspapers we read about how to optimize our lives, and constantly governed by factories, in offices or in universities, or I work in a university, endlessly measured and metric to size about everything. And so there is this contradiction. At the very point at which you're told to achieve anything you can achieve, and you should achieve anything you like, you find you can't achieve anything really that really matters. And your capacity to concentrate and focus is you find yourself utterly distracted, endless social media, this and the other. And so into that, that produces exhaustion, that produces distraction, that produces anxiety, endless neurosis, and also resentment and rage. And that at that point, these authoritarian figures, these avatars of achievement, the Musks, the Trumps, the Andrew Tates, these figures are the avatars of success. Albeit they're not the kind of success you or I might identify with, but they do identify a certain kind of success by any means necessary. Now, they want a society that doesn't have regulation, that wants to get rid of all constraint. They want to return to a kind of social Darwinian world in which the strongest and fittest survive, and that's a kind of hyper-masculine kind of frame. And they're very happy to enlist these currents of Christianity, which has always been there, but which are, for good reason, feeling displaced and disjointed and discombobulated and not knowing how to go on. And these people provide an answer. Through us, we will give you control again. We will bring order again. We will enable life to come out right. And they do that through, not through calling into question the structures of political economy which benefit them, but by telling everyone, look over there. We'll make enemies of the migrants, the elites, the intellectuals, the whoever their enemy of the day is, and create these strong friend-enemy divisions. And then we all get outraged at that and feed in, and the outrage machine just feeds itself, and we end up with more polarization. But I think the thing, and I'll end with this, I think, and this is kind of the last point, I think the thing we really need to pay attention to, and I think each of you, I know many of you, are involved in these struggles. And it's always the same struggle. It's the struggle that Olodum Aquino and the Sons of Africa engaged in the formation of the abolition movement as they struggled against the political economy of slavery and its exploitation and extractive economy. It's the same struggle as those who formed the labor movement in industrial capitalism, and as they struggle to form things like cooperatives, unions, and credit unions, and form more human forms of economy that actually restored agency to people. It's the same struggle that people like Ella Baker and Septimus Clark and Martin Luther King against the Jim Crow, which wasn't just a set of laws, it's also a political economy that wanted cheap labor to supply its factories in the South. And they did the hard work of rebuilding networks of trust and rebuilding and organizing people to resist that. And it's the same struggle that Desmond Tutu, a great hero of Greenbelt, built in the anti-apartheid movement. And it's our struggle. Algorithmic capitalism is building a new structure to exploit you and extract your labor, and particularly wants poor, serviceable workers to do that, and is mobilizing political theologies to that end. And it will benefit these rich figures like Musk and Peter Thiel and their kind of political allies like J.D. Vance. And the question is, how do we respond to that? And that is something to pay attention to. It's a return of an authoritarian politics in a new form of political economy that's emerging around us. And the challenge is the same old challenge. It's the soul-stretching but soul-magnifying work of being faithful, hopeful, and loving people that answers a culture riven with despair, that has forgotten how to hope, of a culture that is riven with suspicion, that doesn't know how to trust and keep faith with each other, and a culture that has given up caring, that thinks it's toxic empathy, and we need to teach it again how to love one another. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Luke. I think that's given us a really helpful framing, particularly in the US context. And I think one of the things that's very striking, if you read a lot of those figures, is how often they are co-opting the same sort of language that we might seek to use. like the common good, for example. They talk a lot about virtues, and they're appropriating that language into their sets of frameworks. That's a really helpful starting point for us to kind of frame things. Let me just then move over to Chinny and perhaps focusing a little bit more on the UK context and that kind of public and civic space and how it feels from your perspective on how things have perhaps shifted in the last few years and how much of that is kind of coming, as it were, here, and what there may be in terms of kind of more homegrown dynamics, or how you're seeing it as the director of a think tank, very much looking at this. Thanks.
So it's very hard to follow Professor Luke Bretherton, but I'll just...
you have the room.
I have the room. Right, so there are... You could say, in some respects, that I am a Christian nationalist. And I've been thinking about the different types of Christian nationalists that we might be talking about. So when Luke asked, what exactly are we talking about? Are we talking about Stephen Yaxley-Lennon, or could we be talking about me? And the reason why I say that is because I've committed my life to trying to communicate that the Christian faith is good news for us as individuals, but also for us as a society, as a nation. I think that Christianity is good for all of us. I think that a Christian nation, if it was a truly Christian nation, would be a really good thing. Now, a few months ago, I heard Tom Wright, N.T. Wright, speak about this whole topic of Christian nationalism. And he said, show me a nation where there is no oppression, where prisoners are set free, where there is no poverty, where there is healing, and I will show you a Christian nation. The problem for me in these conversations about Christian nationalism, or what I hear from people who describe themselves as Christian nationalists, is that that's not what I'm hearing. I'm not hearing about kind of the messianic imperatives. I'm not hearing about love. I'm not hearing about the open-armed love of Jesus. What I'm hearing is there is an us and there is a them. There are the good people and there is the enemy. And those good people, the right people, the ultimate person is a strong white man. So I'm interested in the ways in which race plays into this conversation in a way that people can sometimes try and deny. It's kind of like other things, but I think race and racism is at the heart of some of these conversations. As I said, I lead Theos, the Religion and Society think tank, and we have never been busier. You could say that basically we've got what we wanted, which is for 20 years, Theos has been saying Christianity is good news for society. And so now we're seeing that. You can no longer say that religion, that Christianity is irrelevant to our society. But we're kind of like, oh, not like that. that's not what we meant. But we're constantly being asked about this phenomenon. So we've been doing some research to try and unpack what Christian nationalism is. We're doing a comparative study of 5 European countries and what's happening there. And what we see is that it's really, really complicated. It's not just that there's a load of Christian nationalists who believe that you have to be Christian to be English in particular. But actually, there are people, I think it's 41% of people, who believe that Christian values are good for a nation. What are Christian values was a question that came up yesterday. And this stuff is deliberately vague. And it's so vague because it's so vague deliberately. It's great comms because people can put into the bucket of nationalism or unite the kingdom everything that they are dissatisfied with. So some of what Luke was talking about around crisis of agency, about cost of living, around all of these political and socio-political issues that the United Kingdom has faced in recent decades that put us in this very particular moment that makes people susceptible to some of these messages. So I think that it is a crisis of belonging, first of all. I don't think Christian nationalism begins primarily with theology. I think it begins with a set of questions that are actually deeply human ones. Who am I? Where do I belong? Who are my people? I think we also shouldn't underestimate the very simple fact that humans are simple. people like being part of a winning side or being part of an adventure or a mission. I listened to the Rest is History podcast on the Ku Klux Klan, a three-part episode recently. Highly recommend listening to it. But what you hear there is that there were Methodist ministers, female Methodist ministers and Quakers recruiting for the Ku Klux Klan back in the different kind of iterations of the Klan. There were lots of young men who were dissatisfied with the state of their lives, that wanted to belong to a sense of adventure or put on a uniform or be part of something. I think sometimes what is happening when we see Tommy Robinson, Stephen Yaxley Lennon and his crew is people just wanting to join something. Also, it's not just white people that are part of these groups. If you go to a Unite the Kingdom rally, you'll see people of colour. What is happening there? Don't they kind of understand what's going on? I think for some of those people, they too want that sense of adventure and that sense of belonging. They just too feel a sense of dissatisfaction with their own lives. So they want to kind of join that. And I'll finally say that my book, God is Not a White Man, came out in 2021. And the context into which that was released, you know, Black Lives Matter, post-Black Lives Matter, was a very different one kind of fight than it is 5 years on. I was invited to lots of places to talk about race. It felt like there was a reckoning with racial injustice. It felt like people were really paying attention. But I think that's also part of what's led us to this point. I think a lot of people were watching what was going on in that time and not liking it and feeling that they were losing a sense of their own power and their own agency and their own place in our society. So often I think about what comes after Barack Obama. Donald Trump comes after Barack Obama, because there are people who are like, actually, enough of that. I want to reassert my own position in society. I want to feel important. And so often that is intertwined with ideas about race, about who is valued in our society. I won't go on to kind of immigration stuff, but it's kind of complicated. But it's about a big story that people are invited into.
Thank you very much. Kind of just pick up on a couple of things that, I mean, I'm totally with that kind of white lash, if you want to use that language expression. It was very, very clear in the US, I think, particularly with the shift from Obama. And if we think back to Black Lives Matter and the situation with Jason Arde over the last, you know, month or so, relentless hounding of an individual who'd made it very clear that he was personally vulnerable as a neurodivergent person who had a complex life. And you kind of put that against the Black Lives Matter moment. It feels extraordinary because it's a repetition. It's the same sort of pattern of what is going on. And I just wonder whether the question of when people talk about British identity, English identity, they often come back to the question of empire and nostalgia for a sense of being, a sense of belonging, a sense of pride in that whole history. I just wonder if you have any kind of reflections about the question of empire and whether that's still sitting. I think if Anthony was here, he would be saying Brexit, empire. You know, there's a real connection. I just wonder if you have a kind of sense of where that sits within the sense of belonging and the sense of pride and how that kind of connects to what's gone on in this shift from 21 through to what we've just all seen in terms of Jason Arde.
Yeah, I think what we had in empire, had an empire was a clear sense of hierarchies, who was at the top and who was at the bottom. And I think in the conversations in recent years, some people feel like it's not clear anymore and they feel like they should be at the top and actually they're at the bottom. Or these people should be at the bottom and they're at the top. And that is, you know, obviously, I don't think there should be any hierarchies, and I don't think that the Christian faith talks about hierarchies in that way, but I think that's also there underneath the surface. I don't think we would have had the Jason Arde situation if we hadn't had the past 5 years, post-Black Lives Matter, because at the heart of the Jason Arde backlash conversations is one that is anti-DEI that we didn't say 2 years ago, because that's a definite import from America. We used to say EDI, we now say DEI, anti-DEI, this idea that actually black people are obviously not intelligent enough to be a professor at Cambridge. They're obviously inferior intellectually. So they've just been propelled into this, these positions. And I know that that's why, you know, Anthony isn't here, because he is facing some of those criticisms publicly. He's facing some questions from the media. This is absolutely abhorrent in 2026 that we are even facing these questions. So as much as people might talk about what Jason Arde did and didn't do, what I've been really heartbroken by is the co-opting of the Jason Arde story to reaffirm, you know, the "see, we told you" that these people are actually at the bottom and you've put them at the top. And that's just not acceptable.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we'll pick up on some of those questions as we go through. Let me then turn to Harriet. And I mentioned earlier, back in 1998, you did some quite intense work on fundamentalism. Feels a long time ago, and it feels like the shapes of that have shifted. I'm just wondering if you can reflect a little bit on that. And then perhaps there feels like quite a lot of anxiety and trauma around this subject, if I can put it like that, whether you've got any reflections do you want to draw on
that? Gosh, thanks so much, because there's so much now in the room, so much now in the tent. And I will speak to the kind of earlier studies of fundamentalism, but just to, Ginny, when you were saying, oh no, we would love Christianity to be more present, but oh no, not like that. I had a really interesting, just off-the-cuff remark from my daughter, who's in her late teens, a couple of years ago. She had a new friend who's Christian. She's not used to that. She's not used to people being Christian apart from her parents. So, and this was up in Scotland. And she said, she had this new friend. She said, oh, he's Christian, Mum. And I said, oh. And then she said, but you know, Christian like you, not in a way that's horrible to people. and it was completely unself-conscious. And it's what she sees, I guess, on TikTok and stuff. It's like, well, Christianity means that you are anti this, that, and the other, which is such a sadness, isn't it? And I think to link this to sort of conservative types of Christianity of the ilk we're talking about, fundamentalism was always an awkward coalition. I mean, it would be really surprising people coming together because they had certain fears over which they were, to which they were reacting, and they were wanting a practical solution. And I guess we're seeing that now. So in the 1920s, which is when the term fundamentalism was first used, you had the sort of Princeton, very intellectual theologians who were supporting a doctrine of the Bible that it was inerrant, that it made no mistake. So that was an intellectual position. It's actually not, it's not defensible. You can unpick it, but you have to do quite a lot of hard thinking to unpick it, you know, their logic. But they were unhappy bedfellows with six-day creationists, which they were not at all, with premillennial revivalists who were expecting Jesus to return through the clouds at any moment. You had staunch Calvinists together with very much a kind of experiential worshipping folk. It's all a very weird coalition, but it came together because of what they were frightened of and what they were reacting against. And I think we see some of that today. One of the things that is both newer and also very old is the anti-Islam aspect. And really, when the term Christian nationalism is used and when people are marching in this country now, the enemy is Islam or wokeism. It's both. And they will talk about both. And Islam, the language is, the fear is that Islam is a religion whose intention is to grow, and our fear is that Sharia law will come back. I mean, it sounds really strange to think that would be a fear, but it's a displacement, I guess, of other fears, such as, will I be able to afford heating this winter, and will I be able to get urgent medical, you know, and then blaming on others the possibility that I might not get the medical treatment that I need. So I think there's a sort of displacement of fears. And so one of the things we do want to do is calm the anxiety. And I think that also we want to be clear that we are again having people together in awkward coalitions. So I mean there are cynical, pragmatic organisers of rallies who go around the country and put on to Telegram and elsewhere, meet at this such and such a place at such and such a time. And then others who might have very different sorts of concerns and might have some specific local concern to their specific place, getting sort of swept up in this. And one of the things we want to avoid is labelling everybody with a big stick-on label, because one thing we do know is that when we stigmatise, we push people more into what we are afraid of them becoming. You know, so if you say, "Well, you are all far right," then that's it's more likely to drive people in that direction, because they've suddenly been hit with this big, "Oh," and then they're more likely to go there. So. I think it's also relevant to calming the anxiety in terms of how do we hear and listen, and we need to hear and listen without stigmatizing, and we need to hear and listen keep holding on to our own integrity, and we need to love while holding on to our own integrity. And we need to love those of whom we are afraid. I mean, the other danger is that we become those who don't identify with so-called Christian nationalism become equally afraid that they're going to take over. I said to Duncan, on the way to the tent here, what if this were a Christian nationalist festival? Would there be 100,000 people here? And actually, you sensibly said, no, I don't think so, because there might be if it was a rally in London. But probably not if it was a sustained, over 3 days, interest in Christian thinking, camping in the rain. I don't know. But, and regular worship, it might not be. It might, maybe it wouldn't. But we do have a fear that this is what Christianity is now meaning to people. I mean, when my daughter said, oh, but not, not in a way that's horrible to people. I mean, it's, you're a bunch of, you're a minority group of Christians who are actually quite nice. And I was sad. I laughed, but I was sad. We have a positive nationalism is one that shows collective responsibility, and part of what we want to do collectively in response to the angst that creates sort of Christian nationalism is learn how to be a collective presence. Learn. We did it at Eucharist this morning. We do it at Greek. How we are a collective presence with ethical responsibility and emotional regulation. And the emotional regulation is how we recognise that when there are things to be alarmed at, but we know how to regulate ourselves, and then we don't become reactive and destructive. And theologically, I find it quite helpful to relate this to. There's a North American biblical theologian called Wes Howard Brook who talks about, he does a kind of broad brush theology of both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. And he says, across the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, we are presented with two types of religion. There's the religion of creation into which we are created and in which everybody is included and which Jesus is always calling us to, because he calls us, he's operating kind of outdoors on the mountains. He goes away to pray. He's there with the, so he's, and then he says that versus the religion of empire, which is the religion really of political force and violence. And he says across these scriptures, we see both playing out, and we are always being called to discern and interpret and choose between them. And I find that really helpful.
Thank you very much, Harriet.
Can I just Yeah, just to pick up, I think it's a fantastic framing, biblical framing there. Just to pick up on a couple of things you were saying, Harriet. I mean, I think there's one thing, your point about labelling and stigmatising folk who identify with these, I think there does have to be a reckoning with, they're not crazy. We can't pathologise people. There's a ways in which there are real things to be concerned about. And there is a way in which it's the kind of putting Christmas, Christ back into Christmas kind of thing. That sentiment, and Tommy Roberts had a march around that, he's not completely wrong. Like, there is a, you know, ways in which Christian talk and people felt legitimately that was not kind of allowed in public and are reacting against something. There are real things, and so Ari Hochschild, who's a sociologist from the States, I think she has a really interesting analysis about why certain groups who identify with these more authoritarian movements, which seem to be against their self-interest, and the kind of strong narrative, which I think is parallel in this country, about, well, certain people have kind of pushed in the queue. And Kate Mann, who's a feminist philosopher, has a great phrase around what she calls aggrieved entitlement. The sense of which I should, and it's what picking up what you were saying, Gina, that I should have, and somehow I've been pushed back. And there is a sense of the system isn't working for me. And that's true. It's not. The question is, who do you blame for that? And then the ways in which certain people who control the algorithms determine who is to blame, and we don't have meaningful conversations about the systemic injustice, which people are genuinely suffering from. So that the kind of modes, the interpretive scripts people are given to make sense of the very real things they're struggling with, and the very real ways in which Christianity hasn't had a kind of good airtime, and there has been a kind of culture of despising it. And so people aren't crazy to react against that. And I think it's important to honour that. And I sometimes talk about the kind of three F words of the left, which is family, faith and flag. And we've kind of given those over to certain reactionary forces. I won't call them conservative, they're reactionary forces. And I think there is a way in which, and I think it's been done very well. If you heard Martin Shaw's presentation, Liz Oldfield's interviewed him, and I've forgotten his name, wonderful young Muslim documentary maker. Him. Yeah. He was. I think they both modeled, we've got various folk in here who do this really well, about how do you talk about a sense of place that isn't exclusionary? How do you talk about a sense of patriotism and loyalty to that which made your life possible? We didn't make the language, the roads, the legal system. We owe it a certain duty of care. And how do we talk about a family which is open and a space of hospitality to others, rather than a kind of defensive, and hold these things not as possessions to be defended, but as gifts to be received and shared? And it seems to me that's a very different posture, but it's not allowing talk of family, faith and flag to be captured and kind of enchanted in a certain way. And how do we re-enchant them and open them out in ways that aren't fearful of talking about them?
Thank you. Just before you answer, just two minute advance warning. We're going to come to questions in the room in 2 minutes' time. It'd be great if they were questions. We've all been there. And short. If you do a short question, you will receive the admiration of everybody else in the room. So we'll come to that after Harriet.
Yeah, thanks very much. I think when we want to try to listen and understand whilst deepening our own integrity. And part of that, I think, is to say blame should not be the modus operandi of the practice of anyone's faith. And that might be a good, you know, a good thing to be, if it's possible to have a conversation. So another thing I think is different from how I had worked in fundamentalism previously was that I used to work with people who might be fundamentalist leaning, and often would end up feeling quite strangled by that, because there isn't much breathing space within it, because the logic is so tight, and if you start to unpick it, the fear is that the whole faith falls apart. So what I would do is look for the key that enables them, that enables anyone, if you're in that sort of situation, to think, actually, my experience or what I love about God, or how I feel the touch of God, or how I came to faith, or whatever it might be, it didn't rely on that really tight logic, actually. So therefore, I can loosen that, and my faith is still there. What I don't know, and I haven't tried it, is what that looks like when one's conversion has been about Christianity being talked up in order to join a crusade against Islam. I don't know what conversion means in that context, but I want to give the benefit of the doubt to actually some really moving testimony that I've heard of people who have gone and got baptized by Kieran Dewar or whoever, who have had what just sounds like actually a really moving Christian conversion. I do not want that to, I don't want them to be stigmatized and distrusted. I want that discipleship to be able to grow. So, yeah.
Thank you.
You're okay. Okay, great. We're now going to go to the room. Like I say, if we could perhaps take two questions at a time, that would be great.
Two mics, one at either side of the table.
Perfect. There's two mics, one at either side. I'm blinded by the light, so please just grab a couple of people. Questions, short, and on the panel, just jump in straight away if you feel, that's me. If none of you jump in, I'll start to point. Okay. First question.
Hiya. If you were met face-to-face with a Christian national, would you dive on in and be that confrontational voice, or would you leave it for the professionals?
Hi, thank you. The church is reckoning with its racism and USPG, for example, the Codrington work and the Lament to Action. In academia, what is happening to help unpick the inheritance of empire and racism, which is part of what contributed to Professor Arday's tragic death? And perhaps, Luke, if there's something you are actively doing in anti-racist work in your setting, given the huge platform that you have there. Thank you.
I think extremism experts basically say there's absolutely no point in confronting someone with why they're wrong, because they are never going to change their mind based on you telling them why they're wrong. What we're called to do, I think, in that situation is ask them how their day was, how are their children, what's keeping you up at night. Just be human and hope that because of that love that you're showing to that person, at some point when they decide to leave whatever extremist views they have, they would have a safe person to come back to.
Thank you.
Just to pick up on that, I mean, I think one of the things is a lot depends on where you begin the conversation. So I don't think one begins with confrontation. And something I've kind of practiced, and it was a thing developing when I was living in the southeast of the States, where particularly around questions of climate skepticism and climate denial, which is now connected into a lot of these kinds of movements. And that's the other thing, they want to roll back climate protections, these kind of authoritarian movements, was beginning with a question of what do you love? And so just in relation to the climate question was, well, do you love hunting and fishing? And often they would. And then, so what about it do you love? And then what would it mean for your children and your children's children to be able to hunt and fish where you hunt and fish? Now, to my progressive colleagues, like, hunting and fishing, And I'm like, but that's where people are at, and that's how they connect to the land. And so beginning with what people love and then what they're concerned about, because often there's a great tradition in community organizing where it looks to the roots of anger, which comes from the Norse word, anger, which means grief, the sense of loss. And a lot of this rage and anger comes out of, whether misplaced and wrong or right, it comes out of a sense of loss and grief that's curdled. And we move from the curdling of grief into grievance. And so I think that's, you have to begin with what people love and what they feel they're losing and what isn't cherished or held sacred. So I think that's the place to begin the conversation and move on from there. In relation to your very good question about that, I inherit a very particular situation. The previous incumbent of my post was very pro-empire, shall we say. And so I've kind of been involved in anti-racist work in the States and here through forms of organizing. Community organizing actually goes back. Saul Alinsky, who I've written on extensively, very explicitly saw his work as a form of anti-fascist organizing. And I think the work I'm trying to do is, I think Alinsky has this great rule in his Rules for Radicals that there is the kind of price of a successful attack is a constructive alternative. And so what I'm trying to do is develop a kind of notion of Christian humanism as a constructive alternative to the kind of forms, the ways in which both in academia and more broadly, the question of dehumanizing forms and racism as a dehumanizing form that gets caught up. I'm very influenced by black Marxist thinkers like Cedric Robinson and others who talk about racial capitalism rather than just focusing on questions of identity per se, but ask questions about how does racism connect into capitalism and there from the kind of emergence of chattel slavery on. So there's both academic work around that, but there's also recovering a canon of figures like Olodur Equiano, like Mary Prince, like Kugwano, but others who haven't actually, we don't have a canon of anti-racist figures who, the Paul Gilroy, who I've done some work with recently, who has his term, the Black Atlantic. And I think it's a really rich history and tradition and set of texts which need to be drawn into theological education and academia more broadly and engaged with as part of the canons of how we think about the emergence of this world and how they were thinking through questions of racial capitalism from the very outset, and that challenge both, I think, a kind of overly identitarian frame on the one hand, but also a frame that just focuses on questions of class and ignores questions of identity. So there's kind of bigger academic debates around that I'm engaged in, but I'm also trying to build up institutional forms, studentships, postdocs, for figures who can engage with this canon, and then also that's building up a cohort of kind of theologians, and I'm working with Anthony Reddy on this in the Oxford context, to try and create the kind of material and social conditions institutionally at Oxford and then more broadly to actually have people who can think, so there can be more black academics and more academics who are really thinking through theologically these questions of racial capitalism and how they're constantly reinscribed in the contemporary context. But that's the bit that falls within my particular responsibilities.
You've got a fantastic piece on Equiano,
which
is easily available, which I think is, anyone who knows the interesting narrative of Equiano, fascinating book. To have him rehabilitated as a theologian and a Christian thinker, really interesting piece of work.
Hi, so. I'm involved in interfaith engagement and community organising in East Lancashire, and I totally get that distinguishing between those people going on marches who are aggrieved and deprived, and as Luke said, for whom grief has been channeled into grievance. I'm interested in the leaders, if you like, and on the panel, I think I could say that Luke talked about authoritarian, Chini talked about racism, Harriet talked about anti-Islam. Is there a unifying feature, or is it like Brexit, which was a convenient tool to harvest people, leaders with different agendas, using take back control as a common slogan? So is there an underlying unifying philosophy, or are different people in leadership, you know, coming together to push their own agendas?
Thank you. We'll hold that. And the second question?
What seemed to be missing from the Christian nationalist agenda was the concept of loving your enemy, praying for those that you perceive to be persecuting you. My question is, if I see their theology as antithetical, if you like, the enemy of mine, how do we love them?
In recent months, I've just become aware of the many, many, many Christians who are engaging in these conversations, not just at a theoretical level, but going to marches, going to protests, hosting kind of chaplaincy spaces within the Unite the Kingdom marches, having conversations, trying to love people and trying to demonstrate what it means to love other people as much as you love yourself. So I think for all of us, it is a challenge to all of us, not just to talk about love, but act in a loving way towards everyone, including those with whom we profoundly disagree. I think that's how we will demonstrate a different kind of example. On the question of, I'm not sure that you could define necessarily one philosophy, because there are lots of different ideas going on. I think maybe you could say that power is the thing that people, whatever context that they are coming from, are wanting and seeking. And they they're kind of sometimes using Christianity for that. But actually, like Harriet said, there are some, you know, genuine believers who are also Christian nationalists. It's not that just that if you're a Christian nationalist, you're not really a Christian. So some of that is going on there as well. But I thought it was really interesting that Tommy Robinson, when he, it seemed to be that there were lots of Christian symbols, and which was at his September, whatever it was, last year or the year before march. So therefore, he went big on the Christianity with the Christmas march. But then only 1,000 people turned up. So then he kind of put that messaging aside for the next march, and then had 100,000 people. So clearly, he's sometimes using it, and sometimes not. And while I have the mic, I will say that I would appeal to lots of you who are white people who hold power in different institutions. I have heard more about Oluwadu Equiano from Luke Bretherton than I have from anyone ever. And Luke is constantly talking about black theology, black Christian humanism, all of these ideas. And people listen to him because he's a white man, not because he's also Luke, but it's not, no one's saying, oh, well, you would say that, wouldn't you, because you're black. So I think if you can learn from what Luke's saying, seek black theologians and black thinkers that you can then kind of quote yourself, that would be a great help for all of us. Thank you.
So just very quickly, I think there probably isn't one thing, and it's maybe wise to just realise that this is a rag bag of different things coming together pragmatically. On love your enemies, it's really challenging because we're asked to love our enemies while they are our enemies, you know, aren't we? And sometimes we can hear that as love your enemies by making them into your friends, but that's not what the instruction is. Lovely if friendship follows down the line, but we are asked to love our enemies whilst they are our enemies, and Jesus did model that. I mean, I tend to think de-escalate, 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 and I'm not sure Jesus modeled that. And I'm interested, you know, that is always a challenge. You know, what he just went in and said all sorts of inflammatory stuff, and he did. But ended by demonstrating what it looks like to love your enemies while they are your enemies. I think one thing that I, because something you were interested in is what this means for training ordinands, and one thing I think that we all need training in and an understanding of is dispassion. I don't know that we can love our enemies unless we've got dispassion, that certain type of detachment. I mean, we paradoxically, we need passion and dispassion, and that's what Jesus displayed. Passion on the, his passion was the cross, and his dispassion was, Father, forgive them, they know not what they are doing. And dispassion is what helps us with the emotional regulation. So that's one of the skills I want to be training ordinands. And just to say, I've got some flyers here for some training we're running at Cuddeston specifically around this. So if you're interested, I'll leave them at the front, and then you can come and take one.
Just quickly on the, so I think in response to the, is there a unified ideology? I think you have to take kind of two levels. I think at the kind of level of Musk, Peter Thiel, those kinds of characters, I think there is a shared framework. It's a kind of metastasized libertarianism. And there's a great book by Laura Fields called Furious Minds, which kind of charts the constellation of different, it's a kind of intellectual history, and I think it is important, and a number of people mentioned this, there's serious intellectual energy and thought going in at this kind of higher level and a real investment there. I think at the other level, and this is where you have the kind of intersection of a certain Christian theology with these political theologies, and it's kind of long-standing notions of salvation in highly individualistic terms, very suspicious of questions of how Jesus engages in structural justice and questions of distributive justice. So somehow, no, that's socialism, or that's wrong, or that's outside of we shouldn't be focusing on that. A kind of, actually, I think, which is a real challenge, a focus on care for the poor. There is a care for the poor there, but it's understood not in terms of changing structures, but in terms of humanitarian service provision. So it's just soup kitchens rather than actually do we need new welfare structures or reform of education systems. So I think there is, at that kind of slightly nearer the ground level, a kind of constellation of quite long-standing theological frames of reference that emphasize, that can tie into these libertarian frames of reference, because it is all about individual and individual salvation, not about social structures. It is all about individual charity and the church being good at charity, and we don't need the state to intervene. And so I think there are currents there that feed into it. So it's important to kind of see the, this distinct, but also where the resonances go.
Thank you very much, Luke. I'm afraid we have USPG wants to continue to be a partner with Greenbelt, and we've hit the time. So I don't want to create a knock-on challenge. So I just want to say a huge thank you to our panelists. Let's give it up for them.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.